Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, let's start with our good martini, which was one of our bad martinis earlier in the week when it looked like there was going to be a pretty tough, if not almost impossible, confirmation fight for the president's choice of Gina Haspel to be the next director of the CIA. And that's because there had been widespread reporting out there that she had overseen the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah at a CIA station in Thailand shortly after 9/11. Well, turns out there's actually a much different story there, which should hopefully help Gina Haspel. This is courtesy of ProPublica. On February 22nd, 2017, ProPublica published a story that inaccurately described Gina Haspel's role in the treatment of Abu Zubaydah, a suspected al-Qaeda leader who was imprisoned by the CIA at a secret black site in Thailand in 2002. The story said that Haspel, a career CIA officer who President Trump has nominated to be the next director of Central Intelligence, oversaw the clandestine base where Zubaydah was subjected to waterboarding and other coercive interrogation methods that are widely seen as torture. The story also said she mocked the prisoner's suffering in a private conversation. Neither of these assertions is correct, and we retract them. It's now clear that Haspel did not take charge of the base until after the interrogation of Zubaydah ended. James Mitchell, the psychologist and CIA contractor who helped to direct the waterboarding of both suspects, said in a broadcast interview on March 14th that Haspel was not the chief of base, whom he described in his book as making fun of Zubaydah's suffering. That chief of base was not Gina, Mitchell told Fox Business News. She's not the COB I was talking about. Mitchell's book, Enhanced Interrogation, Inside the Minds and Motives of the Islamic Terrorist Trying to Destroy America, referred to the chief of base in Thailand as both he and she. Listen to this now. We erroneously assumed that this was an effort by Mitchell or the agency to conceal the gender of the single official involved. It is now clear that Mitchell was actually referring to two different people. Jim, this reminds me of the 1992 film A Few Good Men, when Demi Moore didn't tell Tom Cruise that her client, who had given the code red to Private Santiago, as you might remember, wasn't actually there when Kiefer Sutherland's character issued the order for the code red. And it led to this quote from Tom Cruise that I think is kind of appropriate here.
Wasn't even there. That was an important piece of information, don't you think?
So, Jim, kind of important to get the story right. There are retractions, Greg, about misspelling people's names. This one's pretty huge.
Greg, you remember that old saying about the word assume? When you assume, you make an ass out of you and me, which is, you know, also an easy way to remember how to spell it. Now, you know, there's an old saying of, you know, a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth can get its boots on. I am looking at Politico, a typically understated headline by Alberto Mora, quote, Gina Haspel is a torturer. What else does the Senate need to know? Now, here's the thing. Even under the worst accounts, it was never that Haspel herself was participating in the waterboarding. But right now, this is, let's see, this is dated March 15th, meaning just yesterday. And right there in the paragraph, right there, you know, in the piece, it says, quote, she reportedly ran the CIA's torture black site in Thailand and directly supervised the inhuman interrogations of al-Qaeda suspects Abu Zubaydah and Abid al-Rahim al-Nashiri. But I don't think, I've never heard her connected to al-Nashiri, so there's that question. But then the next question is, oh, by the way, this thing you're citing from ProPublica is false. As of, you know, it's now been probably a good, well, if not 24 hours, we're coming up on 24 hours since the correction from ProPublica. I don't see any addendum. I don't see any correction to this Politico piece. And certainly this further weakens an already implausible hyperbolic headline that she's a torturer. My boss, Rich Lowry, has a good column pointing out the fact that, like, look, whether you like this policy or you hate this policy, this was the policy that was put in place well above Haspel's decision making. And her, you know, the question was, are you going to punish someone for doing what they were asked to do at a time of crisis right after 9/11? It's become very, very convenient to say, oh, you know what, now that we feel safer, right? Now that, you know, a lot of time has passed, two administrations, we're going to say, we're going to blame you for that, for doing what you were told to do. I keep getting a lot of, you know, this is just like saying, just following orders, Jim. It's just the same as the Nazi and Japanese war criminals. Well, I'm sorry. I don't think waterboarding Zubeda is on the same moral par with the Holocaust or the Bataan Death March. We can very much debate the waterboarding. I think the fact that the U.S. has not gone back to it and only used it in the cases of those three terrorists indicates that we have moral qualms about it. Yes, there are lines we don't necessarily want to cross. And the fact that we haven't used it since indicates that we've concluded this is not either, both not an effective tool and not something we want to do. But if you're looking for good, competent leadership in important positions around President Trump, don't try to bork Gina Haspel. This is about as good as it's going to get under this administration. She's widely respected. She's trusted. Even Dianne Feinstein, one of the most vocal critics of this program, had nothing but nice things to say about her, at least initially. And now, of course, she's saying she wants to hear more information about the program, et cetera, et cetera. Not the first time in the last couple of weeks we've seen Dianne Feinstein make a sudden, abrupt adjustment in a matter of days when someone informs her of what her previous position was. But either way, seems like a rather implausible argument to hold up an otherwise competent nominee in an institution and an administration that very much needs them. So hopefully this will derail some of the opposition that had been building to this nomination.
Yeah, not only that, it also, once again, provides more evidence to whenever there's a major retraction on a story these days, Jim, it always seems like the initial reporting was wrong in a certain direction. It's always towards conservatives or towards the Trump administration. It's never, oh, we said this wonderful thing about the Trump administration that turned out not to be true. It's always, oh, we trashed this person. And actually, it's not true.
It's very interesting that people very rarely make errors in the direction they don't want the facts to be. Oh, you know, it turns out that the Republican nominee embezzled a lot more money than we thought, or that the sex scandal was much worse than we thought. We just underplayed it out of a sheer, you know, accidental error, et cetera, et cetera. Never seems to go that way.
No, not at all. All right. Let's move on to the bad martini now, Jim. And of course, one of the things we're seeing this week that's big in the political news is that it looks like Connor Lamb is going to be the next congressman from Pennsylvania's 18th district. I don't think it's been officially certified yet, but he gets the proud, proud honor of serving in the House of Representatives until this district disappears here in the next few months under the Democrats' own map. So I'm sure he's thrilled about that. But a lot of different people are writing the narrative, oh, Connor Lamb dissed Nancy Pelosi, blueprint for you other Democrats trying to win in competitive or even red-leaning districts. So here's Politico writing about this. A half dozen Democratic House members and candidates told Politico in interviews that they had been closely monitoring how Lamb handled the Pelosi attack. In one notable ad, the 33-year-old Marine faced the camera and called the claim that he's a clone of the Democratic leader, quote, a big lie. I've already said on the front page of the newspaper that I don't support Nancy Pelosi, unquote. Even moderate success in other Trump strongholds would likely flip the House to Democrats. Quote, if we're going to take the majority, it's going to be because we win districts like that, said Representative Philemon Vela of Texas, a vocal critic of current leadership. Quote, running against Nancy Pelosi is going to help you a lot more than running with her. And then Seth Moulton up in Massachusetts, also not a fan of Pelosi's leadership, says, I think everyone's watching what Connor Lamb's doing, and I hope they're taking notes. So, Jim, I think it's genuine that folks like Seth Moulton and others are tired of Nancy Pelosi's leadership. But here's the thing. Even if the Democrats take back the House, Nancy Pelosi's allies are still almost guaranteed to make up a majority of the Democratic caucus. So there could be a nice, ugly fight inside the caucus when they're actually choosing their leader shortly after the election. But when Nancy Pelosi comes out on top, all these people are going to toe the line, or at least the vast majority of them, when it comes time to vote for the actual speaker come January of 2019. Nancy Pelosi's pushing 80 years old. She didn't hang around for an additional 8 years in the minority so she could gracefully bow out and let somebody else take her spot. She knows where the bodies are buried, and she has every intention of being speaker again.
Yeah, there are two ways to interpret this, and both of them have very bad repercussions for the Republican Party. The first, and probably I think the most plausible one, is that most of these Democrats don't really mean it. They will take this position on the campaign trail. It'll be very familiar. We've seen this in a lot of red states and a lot of red districts. Oh, I'm a centrist Democrat. I'm a moderate Democrat. I'm not like all those other, Beltway Democrats. I'm mad at the leadership of both parties. Let me tell you 30 minutes of why the Republicans are bad. And in the end, I'll make some vague criticism in the Democratic direction. We've seen this a lot of times. You could argue it worked in for Lamb. It wasn't that different from what John Ossoff was trying to do in the Georgia special House race, and didn't quite turn out the way he wanted. So my guess is that if the Democrats take the House, most of these people will turn around. If they don't immediately vote for Pelosi, Some of them actually might, you know, just completely reverse themselves. Others might make a symbolic vote against her, but will then quickly go back to falling in line and kissing the tush of the leader, because that's what you want to do. You want to get on those good committees. You want to get her to come and help you out with fundraising, all the different ways that Hillary, the Speaker of the House, with the Freudian slip, all the different ways that the Speaker of the House, if it's Nancy Pelosi, can help your career or hurt your career. You know, most of these Democrats will fall in line. But there's another possibility, Greg, that I don't know if we've really considered it enough. This is really bad news for Republicans if this is indeed the case. Greg, what if Democrats are actually learning and they realize that Nancy Pelosi is a terrible leader? I mean, this has been one of the biggest advantages of House Republicans going back probably at least since 2010, if not earlier, that, you know, she is a terrible representative for the party, a San Francisco liberal who literally lives on Billionaire's Row, who runs around saying things like the tax cuts are crumbs and all kinds of stuff. Like, whatever Democratic argument is being advanced, you and I, people, longtime listeners of this podcast, know our perspective on Harry Reid. Way to go, Nevada. Way to go. You can understand, you know, crazy Uncle Joe Biden. You can look at a bunch of Democratic leaders, but it was always Nancy Pelosi who would come out and say something like, we have to pass the bill in order to let you, so you can see what's in it. She had an amazing way of making the least persuasive, most unnerving arguments for her perspectives, for saying things that are just flat out not true. If Nancy Pelosi did not exist, then the National Republican Congressional Committee would have to invent her, right? She is the distilled essence of liberalism that most Republicans want to run against. And so whoever they were running against in any district across the country, you'd see, you know, John Smith supports Nancy Pelosi in the way, you know, and you'd fill in the policy agreements there, right? And you could beat a lot of House Democrats by tying them to Nancy Pelosi. Past experience tells us most House Democrats will fall in line. This is how they built their House majorities in 06, and they were helped by the Obama wave in 2008. They had a bunch of candidates who did not have records in state legislators, who hadn't voted to raise taxes a bazillion times, who could somewhat more plausibly make the argument, I'm not like all those other Democrats. Picture Heath Shuler in North Carolina as one of the classic examples of this. But something funny happened. You put these guys in Congress with a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic House, and all of a sudden they start voting in line, you know. Maybe one or two didn't vote for the cap and trade. Maybe one or two didn't vote for Obamacare. But by and large, most of them voted for the Obama agenda in 2009 and 2010. On Election Day 2010, they paid the price. So my suspicion is that we have a lot of faux centrists out there, a lot of posing moderates claiming to not be happy with Nancy Pelosi, who will fall in line under her or any similar House Democratic Democratic Speaker of the House in the future. But, you know, there is a slim possibility of really learning from this. And at some point, we will have the same kind of liberalism, but with a, you know, more appealing saleswoman running things for the Democrats.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, I don't think the party's shifting. As nice as that would be, back towards rationality, the fact that most of the party is upset that a socialist got screwed out of the Democratic Party nomination is a sign that that's probably not heading in a direction we would like. All right, let's talk about somebody we just love to talk about, Jim. Let's move to our crazy martini. Jeff Flake is disappointed in the president and in Republicans. I know, it's a big surprise. He never talks about it. He's always focused on policy and ways to help the American people. He's not worried about the optics and making a point on the Senate floor. Of course he is. That's all Jeff Flake's been doing ever since Donald Trump became president. And now he's making news for a couple different reasons. First of all, he's speaking today at the Politics and Eggs breakfast event at St. Anselm College, which happens to be in New Hampshire, which is fueling speculation that he might be interested in challenging President Trump in a Republican primary in 2020. He says right now he's not planning to, but he's not closing the door on it. Yesterday, he gave a speech at the National Press Club here in Washington, where once again he denounced the president's conduct in office and his own party for enabling the president.
If my party is going to try to pass off the degradation of the United States and her values from the White House as normal, if we're going to cloister ourselves in the alternative truth of an erratic leader, if we are going to refuse to live in the world that everyone else lives in and reckon with the daily reality that they face, including their very real and understandable anxiety that they feel, then my party might not deserve to lead.
might not deserve to lead. Jim, there's a lot of reasons Republicans disappoint us, but I think the alternative is far, far worse. We know that both major party nominees last time were highly defective people. Saw direct evidence of that again of Hillary Clinton this week. And obviously, there's kind of a chaotic environment at the White House. So Jeff Flake can complain for a couple of years, or he could actually try to get stuff done. He's chosen the former.
Yeah, Greg, this is, you know, I think my nomination for the crazy martini would be what exactly Jeff Flake's plan is here. Because, you know, and by the way, if we end up with a scenario in which, you know, primary day 2020 comes along and I'm here in Virginia and I see on my ballot incumbent President Donald Trump, challenger John Kasich, and challenger Jeff Flake, you're just going to hear a lot of sounds from me that aren't happy, that involve only consonants. They don't involve any vowels. Just constant groaning from all that, because it sounds like Jeff Flake wants to give some variation of the John Kasich approach, which is to run as the Republican for people who don't like Republicans. Unfortunately, there aren't that many of them in the Republican presidential primary. Jeff Flake, you know, looked at the evidence and kind of concluded that he would not have a good chance of winning re-election in his home state of Arizona. I don't quite get why he thinks that there is this yearning nationally for a for him to be president of the United States. I don't think there's a yearning for him to be president amongst the Republican Party. I think amongst Republican Party presidential primary voters, it's still a very open question whether there's really any room for a serious challenger to the president. Now, if the 2018 midterms go terribly for Republicans and the general perception is, look, we've got a president with a 40% approval rating, some very bad habits that alienates chunks of the electorate, there's this constant atmosphere of chaos and change and cabinet members coming and going, and this atmosphere of a reality show is hurting what should be an otherwise good policy, that the country is prospering, that we are beating ISIS, that by the objective measures of how the country is doing, Republicans should be doing a lot better. If based on that, Republicans conclude, okay, the president's become dead weight, now we got to look at some other options, maybe there's something that can happen there, but I just don't know if Jeff Flake is the kind of guy. And when your whole message is Trump stinks, and there's not that much of an articulation of what you would put forward, not just as a traditional conservative agenda, although you and I pointed out that, you know, Senator Jeff Flake is a little bit less conservative than House member Jeff Flake was. There's a chunk of populism of Trump that might be salvageable or that might be useful for in the party. You know, maybe the Republican Party doesn't want to be so closely associated with big corporations anymore. Maybe we want to see have some of these blue collar workers stay with us and a perception that we are the ones who are going to help drive up their wages and ensure that we're competitive on a globalized economy. You know, a bunch of these people who've seen their hometowns ravaged by opioids, and when the mill shuts down or the mine shuts down or something like that, well, you know, then maybe they have a good reason to feel forgotten and to feel ignored and to feel like they don't count as much in the American story. So maybe if Jeff Flake has answers to this stuff, I'm all ears. But if it's just Trump stinks, I don't think it's really going to get anywhere. And my sneaking suspicion is that he's ready to become a John Weaver John candidate. And by that, I mean the Republican consultant who managed John Huntsman, John McCain, and John Kasich last cycle, who traditionally runs as the most leftward Republican in the rightward party that generally doesn't get you a heck of a lot of winning states and winning delegates to the convention. It does get you, however, MSNBC gigs. And I would actually, I even have to rescind some of that mockery I used to make of John Huntsman, because right now John Huntsman is our ambassador to Russia. John Huntsman, who had done all kinds of criticism in the Republican Party, figured out, hey, you know what? There's a role for me to help in this administration. I'm going to do it. So I'm just kind of left wondering what exactly the long-term plan, so to speak, is for Jeff Flake and what he wants to do other than become just another figure who was once a consistent conservative Republican and who now sounds a lot more like, say, Evan McMullen.
Jim, you're a conservative. I'm a conservative. We know lots of conservatives. Have you ever, or do you know a conservative who has ever thought, you know what would make things better right now? Maybe if Democrats were in charge.
Only in the, if we put them back in power, they'll overreach and we can come back again sort of thing, which is basically it's like the football equivalent or basketball equivalent of tanking a season. You know what I always prefer to do rather than strategic losing, Greg?
What's that?
Strategic winning. Let's skip the tanking part and actually be good and win. So the other thing, which I think that I it'd be a great question to put to Jeff Flake. Maybe I'll see if I can get to an interview with him. Let's assume Democrats come back in power, either in 2018 or if a Democratic president wins in 2020. Do we think they'll have learned from all of this to take the central path, to not indulge their political ids, so to speak, to not indulge in intersectionality and socialism and, you know, to go as far as left as humanly possible? Or do we think they would just get, you know, Katie bar the door? They're going to do it as, you know, as much as possible. I don't see anything to indicate anything resembling the Democratic Leadership Council and Bill Clinton style, mid-90s style Democrat leadership is coming back. But wouldn't mind seeing it, but wouldn't be counting on that, Greg. And hey, look at that. All of our martinis kind of tie together today, don't they?
We need a break. Oh, it's the weekend. We're finally here. You can actually be grateful that it's Friday and be true, Jim, today. This is good.
There we go. Thank goodness it's Friday. And vacation's next week, right, Greg?
No.
Oh, wait. No, it's the week after that. Ah. See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch. Have a great weekend, everyone.